Hello and welcome to New Books in Terrorism and Organized Crime. I'm Mark Locks. I'm the co-host, along with Sally Lorish, of this new podcast. This week we have Jeff Dean on the show to talk about his new book, Organized Crime, Policing Illegal Business Entrepreneurialism, which is published by Oxford University Press. This is a practical book about organized crime. Jeff and his co-authors, Ivor Vassing and Peter Gottschalk, approach organized crime from a business perspective and try to provide a means of investigating this type of crime from a market point of view. They see an organized crime enterprise like any other business enterprise and say that it must go through the same stages of growth that are experienced by a legal commercial business. The authors are experienced researchers in the methodologies of policing and want to provide a recognition of the entrepreneurial basis of criminal enterprises and investigative methods that pay heed to these characteristics of large criminal organisations. I enjoyed talking to Jeff today, and I hope you enjoy the interview. Okay, hello and welcome to the inaugural podcast of New Books in Terrorism and Organised Crime. I'm Mark Locks, the co-host, along with Sally Lorish, who will be also putting up podcasts for this channel. Today we have Jeff Dean on the show to talk about his new book, Organised Crime, Policing Illegal Business Entrepreneurialism, which is published by Oxford University Press. Jeff is actually one of the co-authors of this book, along with Ivar Falsing and Peter Gottschalk. I might not have pronounced those names correctly. I think Jeff can correct me on the pronunciations. But Jeff, to start off with, do you want to tell us about yourself and how you came to write this book?
Yeah, okay. Thanks, Mark. Well, I'm an associate professor in the School of Justice, and I've worked for many years in the Queensland Police Service as a lecturer in human relations before coming to the university some 20 years ago and specialising in police and law enforcement as my sort of discipline area. In terms of the book, really, this book, which came out in 2010, is really a follow-up book to another book I had written with Oxford University Press in 2007, and that was published by them in the UK on knowledge management, policing and law enforcement, and it really, from that book, I decided to set the stage for how I would apply the concept of knowledge managed policing in that book, which I developed to really organise crime, and that's how it came about.
Right, right. Do you want to explain to everyone what you mean by knowledge management? Because a lot of people probably don't quite understand it. They think about the IT systems of knowledge management.
Yeah, sure. Well, and indeed, knowledge management's been captured, if you like, by IT in the business world to, in terms of developing competitive advantages in a global environment, which is what it's mainly been used for. But really, when I did the research for that original book, it seemed to me that you really had to make some changes to the way knowledge management is seen if you're going to get it to work in policing. It's a totally different context to a business world, and therefore I set about doing that, and as I got more involved with it, it became just an obsession, I suppose, to nail that. So I think that first book really did lay that down well, and I've refined it and trying to distinguish knowledge management in policing and law enforcement, which is that first book, and that's why I've coined the term, if you like, knowledge managed policing, to join those two contexts together. Because if you just use the word knowledge management, people immediately think, as you just did, IT business. So what knowledge managed policing means to me is that really it's first and foremost it's a conceptually oriented framework rather than a technologically oriented one, as in the business world, but really it's a conceptual orientation, because you have to think about it differently for policing, and it's a framework about managing and systematically, if you like, the application of knowledge, and in this case police knowledge. You manage that so you can enhance police effectiveness, and how you manage that is through harnessing and integrating what I would define as practitioner-based tacit knowledge. That's knowledge in the heads of experienced police. They're often overlooked in terms of knowledge management, and because people think about, well, we'll just get an IT system, that'll do the job. But really, it's the practitioners with years of experience that you need to be able to understand and appreciate and develop, because they're the ones that create knowledge. Once it's been created, sure, you have IT systems that can capture it, that store it, can transfer it, can share it, can integrate it, and can apply it. But those systems have to be designed specifically for use with police, and they have to be interoperable, as opposed to a lot of standalone systems that police can have, which really then doesn't get them much value for money. So that's in a nutshell what sort of knowledge managed policing is about.
So in a way, it's about trying to work out the process by which good policing is done via their management of their own internal knowledge and making that implicit knowledge explicit.
Yep. That's right. It really is turning that sort of tacit, hidden, implicit knowledge into something that is that they can utilise in a more formal way through making it explicit or codified in some way. Yeah. And that's a very hard process. The out of that, the second perhaps major issue in knowledge management in the business world as well as in policing is then how do you share that in a meaningful way? And knowledge sharing is very different to knowledge transfer. And knowledge transfer is simply, you know, we'll plug in a computer and stick something on the internet and say, have a look at it, people. You know, that's just transferring it, pushing boxes around, if you like, as opposed to sharing it, which is much more a two-way street, a much more interactive thing, a bit like we're having here with this discussion, you know, about the book. Yeah. It's a process we both contribute to, and hopefully we'll advance our understanding of it as a result of somebody just reading a review of the book or a blob, you know.
That's right. That's right. I think I have to admit, in the interest of full disclosure, that Jeff and I work together, and we're actually one floor apart right now while we're holding this conversation. And Jeff is the master of the visual display of knowledge and information. So both of his books are full of charts and graphs and diagrams that we just won't be able to communicate over an audio recording.
Yeah, people hopefully just have to buy the book. I mean,
that's right.
I have a funny story about that, Mark. When my first book came out of Oxford University Press in the UK, the commissioning editor just said, when we finally sort of got the thing underway, and he said, and I kept sending him all these visualizations, all these diagrams, and he said, how many diagrams do you have in this book? You know, and I ended up, you know, well into the 60s or so. I just can't quite remember in that first book. But he said, we've never published a book with that many diagrams in it before. So when I got the second contract, the first thing the commissioner said, how many diagrams are we going to have in it this time? And I said, well, listen, I'll do you a favour. There'll only be around about 50. It turned out to be 52. So.
Oh, that's good. So you restrained yourself.
I restrained myself, yeah, a little.
So do you want to be able to tell us about the co-authors to the book and how you came to work with them?
Yeah. That's an interesting journey in itself. I'm the principal author because my other two colleagues are Norwegian, and while they write good English and that, in writing a complex book like this, it was really a case of having to have one person that to get the thing to flow, to write it, and to pull it together. So really, I consider both Eva Fassing and Petter Gottschalk, those two guys, as some highly paid researchers that I had working with me, that became also authors because of their contribution to finding stuff for me that I eventually conceptualised in all those diagrams and pulled together in the book. Eva, I've known for about 7 years. He's the chief superintendent at the moment at the Norwegian Police University College in Oslo. But I first came across him when he worked for Kripos, which is the Criminal Investigation Division, and we were doing some sort of profiling work. And so after a number of years of work together, Eva moved into teaching and researching organised crime. So we had a natural link there and affinity with a number of research interests. So that started to get on the way. Petter is a professor of management and leadership in BI University in Norway, which is the only sort of private university, and he does an enormous amount of publishing in different areas and has a keen interest in looking at policing. So he'd contacted Eva and wanted to work with the police, and Eva said, well, you know, really, if you want to work with the police and do some publishing, well, you better speak with Jeff in Australia, because he's the one I work with. And I had to almost give a tick of approval for with Patter to say, yeah, come on board, and we've published a number of things, and then we ended up all together doing this book. So, yeah.
Oh, great, great. And I suppose we should move on and actually talk about the book itself now. Yeah. So, do you want to give us a general rundown of what the book contains and what the purpose was behind writing it?
Yeah, it really, the purpose behind the name in terms of, illegal business entrepreneurialism is really looking at organised crime at the high end. We're not interested in just the small time sort of drug pusher or whatever else or gang that might want to get into that. Or it really is about that high end market where there's a level of sophistication in running a business, and they make huge profits, just unbelievable profits from what they do. So that really hadn't been looked at before in that way. So the book conceptually is structured around three parts. The first part, we talk about the business of crime, because we really had to understand it as a business. The second part was about the phases that are in a criminal business. And the third part was about, how do you police that crime business or businesses? So this first part, if I can just have a few more words about that.
Oh, absolutely.
It's about the entrepreneurialism of organised crime. So, again, there's a lot of people define organised crime in all sorts of ways, and I didn't get really hung up about producing a definition, because not a lot of countries agree on a definition anyway. So I wanted to look at the entrepreneurial side, and for that I looked at a business enterprise sort of paradigm, and what are the sort of, the core capabilities that an entrepreneurial individual has. And then I tried to apply that within the context of criminal enterprises in markets and industries. So that first part really laid that conceptual foundation with that focal framework about business enterprises and about an entrepreneurial framework of the capabilities, or the capacities, or the core characteristics that you would see operating in a high-end criminal business. The second part really was about the phases of a business. Crime businesses follow the same path as anybody who wants to run a business. They first have to establish a crime business or establish a legitimate business. They then seek to expand that, obviously, to increase their profit. They then, if they've been successful and still in business after a few years, they like to try and consolidate that because they've expanded, and with that brings issues. So a period of consolidation goes on, and then if they're really in it for the long haul, they then have to position themselves with a business for the future and its future survivability. And that's exactly the same process that a criminal enterprise will follow. They need to establish it, expand it, consolidate it, and position it. So those four crime phases was really what I started to look at. And then the last phase of the book was how do you police that, which we can maybe talk about a little bit later on.
Yeah. Yep, that's all right. Do you have a good example of one of the groups and how they sort of move through these phases?
Yeah, well, I think the one that, there's lots of examples, but probably the one that comes to mind is the one I used in the book about the Bandidos in Norway, because they were a group that, when the police eventually came to their attention, had been established, and then that phase of expanding. And while they'd been around basically selling drugs, as some organised crime bikie groups do, into that sort of stuff, drugs and prostitution, extortion and so forth, but in terms of this case study, that they had really gotten to the point where they were starting to want to take over other people's turf. And so there was a rival gang in a little seaside village, if you like, in Norway called Kristiansand, which is 5 hours from Oslo on the coast. And come summer, it expands from, you know, a limited number of people to thousands and thousands. And so they had this rival crime group there. And so what they wanted to do was to expand, and they started to do that by having basically, shooting a few of the others to push them out of business, which is one way to, you know, get your message across. Not a very smart one.
Yeah, it's not an option open to the average business.
No, and of course that then raised them as a red flag on the police radar. Up until then, if they had any sense, they wouldn't have done that. And I can talk about other ways that, from a business perspective, they should have gone about their business. But because they were, you know, silly and dumb and stupid, they just started to use violence, which was their, you know, refined talent, if you like. And of course, they didn't get to consolidate the business, because then the police cracked down on them like a ton of bricks, and started arresting everybody and locking people up. So it's an example of a failed business, thankfully. But of course, like every organised crime group, when police cracked down, and this is an interesting example of again an operating principle, if you like, for competitive advantage that criminals use, that they will see that, okay, the police have taken out this gang. And so what police might define as success, the organised criminal from another gang will say, hang on, that's great. Now there's a vacuum. They've taken away the bandito. So now maybe an Albanian organised crime group will come in and take over. Because organised crime groups hate a vacuum. They just love to fill a vacuum. And so they then, so what police might determine as success is actually to the advantage of another group. And that's often the complexities involved here that need to be thought through. That's why I talked about knowledge management in a policing context has to be a conceptually oriented approach rather than just, you know, a bunch of metrics and numbers about how many drug busts were done or people were locked up.
Yeah. So basically, the police are creating market share.
Yeah,
for the competitors.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and they, you know, so they're factored in as part of the business model with a smart organised crime group.
Yeah,
and there's lots of, an example, if you like, of how they could have done that differently from a business perspective. That one of the things that, for example, if the triads were involved, or even the Albanians, because, you know, while they have a reputation for being vicious, the way they go about that is different. So, and also some of the groups in America that have, what would happen is that a merger would take place. So the Bandidos, if they went to the opposition and said, look, there's enough money here for all of us, we want to increase our market share, let's do an alliance, let's create a business model that allows us to expand and work together. The option then, if they don't want to do that, is, okay, we might then start coming around and shooting you, but that's not really in anybody's interest. They could have then increased their market share without drawing attention to the police and being, you know, happily going on with their business, so to speak. But because they weren't that smart, and that's in terms of the way they were going about it, it allowed the thing to be taken down. But again, as I said, that just creates another context for somebody else.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things that's come out a lot in a lot of articles about organised crime the last couple of decades, that the recognition that organised crime groups don't have access to the normal means of resolving issues that other people have. They can't take it to court. They can't take it to arbitration. So they look for other mechanisms to resolve their conflicts. But they have the option of violence that the legitimate businesses don't have.
Yeah, and they also have the option of corruption, you know.
Yes.
Which is a big thing that they can utilise, and they can go about that in extortion and so forth in other ways that a legal business can't do. So so while they don't have the disadvantages of going to court, they wouldn't necessarily see that as a disadvantage. They certainly have other advantages that the legitimate businesses don't have, which is why they can expand and grow in contexts that a legitimate business can't.
Yeah, yeah. Well, maybe we should move on now to the response to all of this. So how do you think the police respond to this illegal business entrepreneurialism?
Well, I mean, police are only one part of the jigsaw in combating organised crime, obviously. You really need a whole-of-government approach, And to give a rather sad example, but certainly they were on conceptually the right track, was what happened in the UK after fluffing around for many years trying to deal with it, and various other organisations involved in bits and pieces of policing. They eventually took a whole of government, joined up, multi-agency approach to organised crime, and that really came out of the Home Office, and the premier organisation, if you like, that led that sort of thing was what was called the Serious Organised Crime Agency in the UK, and that was established in 2006, and it was a non-departmental body, public body, that incorporated a whole lot of people from the National Criminal Intelligence Service, the National Crime Squad, assets recovery agencies, and a whole lot of other things, you know, taxation, immigration. So I joined them all up, and they were having a lot of success because organized crime groups just love the fragmentation in policing because it allows them to just work unseen and across a whole lot of boundaries and structures that never talk to each other. And those sort of knowledge silos, if you like, that operate independently are just, you know, it's just madness if you ever want to effectively deal with organized crime. So the soccer approach was working well until, of course, the GFC hit. And then there wasn't any money in the piggy bank in Britain to fund all this, so it's actually been disbanded.
Yep. I'll just explain to some people, GFC is an Australianism for global financial crisis, in case you weren't aware of that. But
the ones everybody's suffering from, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, and so conceptually it's the way to go, but practically it's a costly business. But really, when you look at the money that organised crime groups and some of them make more than small countries in terms of the their gross domestic product.
Yes.
I mean, the mafia just as a group, a collective of four groups, you know, that they will make more money than countries on an annual basis. It's just extraordinary. I was just going to mention, in terms of policing specifically, then policing really need to take a more strategic approach. And we have a diagram in the book, as you would guess, that talks about targeted policing and competitive policing. And those sectors up there where there's a high police knowledge and high knowledge of that criminal activity is really where they need to be. But most policing that happens is really random, and it's a disadvantage to, you know, as I said, and smart crime groups just run rings around them.
So let's get down to the detail of what you would have them do. I have had the opportunity of actually teaching out of this book, and I know that there's a number of columns and a number of rows and that you run through. Do you want to give people just a brief rundown of the sort of information that you propose to put together to get a clearer knowledge-managed picture of entrepreneurialism and illegal business?
Yeah, look, it's just a shame we just don't have that capacity for a video to see this, but
yes.
Really what you're referring to, Mark, as you well know, is what I call the criminal business analysis matrix, and that's a CBAM, if you like. And in that, you have a row where you have at one side of it the entrepreneurial capabilities that you would see on the left-hand side, where you have things like an opportunity perspective, resources mobilization, decision-making under uncertainty, people cooperation, and then sort of profit maximization. They're the sort of core capacities that anybody that wants to be an entrepreneur needs to develop, or will have at least two or three of those things going for them. You might see a business opportunity, but unless you can maximize that in terms of bringing the resources to bear to deal with it and operate in a high-risk environment and make decisions in that and get people's cooperation, you're not going to maximize your profit. You then have across the top the phases of establishing, expanding, consolidating, and positioning. So you can actually get a developmental model, if you like, of how the business moves through time. But what moves the business along are what I'd call business factors. And those business factors is a number of them, and I'll just maybe mention a few here. But at the expanding, you know, at that establishing phase, they really obviously need an entrepreneurial vision. You have to have some sort of business financing, and you have to have some crime money management, and so forth, so that you start to bring in the capital, you have some operational logistics, and then, of course, you need human resources. As you move along, you want to expand, you need to have factors like business intelligence, violence and corruption, as I said, are factors that organized crime groups use, counterintelligence. So some of the larger, more sophisticated and long-term criminal groups, for example, will actually send what we call clean recruits to the police academy to go through training and become police officers and work their way up into the system. So they have informants from the inside from day one, and these people have been paid to go through the system. And that's their whole role, to be sleepers until such time as they get to a position where they can operate. So not only do they bribe, can you bribe senior police, but you can also place informers there. You then, when you want to consolidate it, you have to look at criminal business connections and partnerships, like we've talked about, legitimate business connections. You need to, if you want to, because the movement from organized crime groups, they will seek to legitimize a number of their other businesses so that they, at the core, they're criminal and illegal, but they will surround themselves with legal business ventures. The Mafia and the Echo Mafia, for example, have done that amazingly well in Italy. You have the intellectual people, not so much intellectual, but influential people that they will connect with, politicians and so forth. And then, of course, they want to position for the long term the factors of a local market share as opposed to a global market share, and then what sort of competitive advantages can they run out to position themselves for the future. I mean, some triads have a 50-year view of what they're doing. You know, they're not interested in what's happening, you know, in the next 5 years, is a mission statement. They have to take a 50-year view.
Yeah. So do you find these groups, the different factors you've got there, are they applicable across the world, so they're not culturally specific?
No, that's right. They're business factors, and wherever there's a business, they'll be used. And that's why it's the book is global in its perspective, and all of the case examples, and there's some 30 or, well, some about 34 diagrams, as I said, about 52 case examples of brief vignettes, and then there's 7 major case studies ranging right across, and all of that's drawn from various parts of the world, which is why my two co-authors that were just so diligent in tracking down an enormous array of material that I could utilise.
Yes, these are your highly paid researchers, you're saying.
Yeah, that's right. As I said, I owe them a great debt in terms of the hard work they put in, but yeah.
So when police are actually looking at all these factors, how do they get the information to feed this information into your tables?
Well, they have intelligence units, obviously, proactive policing, intelligence-led policing, all of those different models of policing come into that. A lot of those factors they will have some handle on already. But obviously, the thing with intelligence units is they'll often just be tasked with a certain job and they'll only be looking at that piece of the puzzle. What this matrix gives them is a holistic view, so they can actually look at the trajectory, if you like, and say, okay, we've got some intel about a this group here, but from those, you know, 16 or so factors that you're looking at, often intelligence units in policing and so forth will only know 4 or 5 of those, or have some idea, or come across them at a certain point. So that's a start. You put those factors down, but the advantage of this diagram and this matrix is, and filling it out, is it gives you that holistic view, so they can begin to take a long-term view and they can begin to think, well, hang on, is this a group that are strategic in what they're doing? How have they gone about establishing themselves? And they can look at it and they can sort of say, well, where did they get their crime money from, you know? Did they go and borrow some money from another crime group, or did they do some bank robberies to get it, and so forth? And the way they've gone about that, and how they, you begin to get an understanding of, well, how savvy these people are, or sophisticated or unsophisticated they are about what they're doing with their crime business. And then righto, they've got a toehold here, and they've come up on our radar. But clearly, the next phase they're going to be involved with is expanding. Now, how are they going to do that? So to expand that, they need some business intelligence. Will they use violence and corruption? Will they use counterintelligence? You know, will they be bribing police officers to know what areas we're targeting? They're the sort of questions they start to ask. So a much more strategic-oriented approach at an executive management level to overview this process is what then begins to happen. And then you begin to say, well, hang on, look, we're only one part in this. We need to know what the tax people are doing. We need to know how they're functioning in other ways, what their contacts are. Obviously, once you've got some intelligence, you use things like surveillance, phone taps, all those other technological whiz-bang things that we have to target people.
Yep. So it's sort of pushing them in the direction of cross-agency and inter-jurisdictional cooperation.
Yeah, and while some of that goes on, I think where it falls down is often, you know, other agencies will begin to think, well, why do they want this information? What's this about? Or it goes a low priority. Whereas if you can have that whole of government approach, or you can have this mud map, if you can take, if you like, this CBAM, criminal business analysis matrix, to an agency and say, listen, this is what we're aiming at. We want to fill in these factors here. You've got information that intelligence or data that can help that. That's why it makes eminent sense to talk about, as I originally said, that knowledge-managed policing is first about having a conceptually-oriented framework, and in terms of the operation of organised crime and high-end criminality, that's in that diagram. And that's the sort of thing that needs to then be discussed and talked about at interdepartmental levels, cross-border meetings with other organisations, so they begin to appreciate that, first of all, you have to be on the same page, you have to have the same concept, the same vision, and see what you're working towards. Then you can do something effectively about it. But at this point in time, you know, the crime groups, you know, intuitively know all this, or the smarter ones have mapped out their business plan like this.
Yep. So they can even use this. Policing agencies could use the matrix as a means of, pushing themselves towards working out whether they're doing their own strategic intelligence sufficiently well, or whether they've got gaps in their knowledge.
Yeah, that's right. But also, I mean, you know, they certainly have strategic intelligence, but it's like the old connecting up the dots problem. Everybody has a part of a dot, but nobody connects it. I mean, obviously, 9/11 is an example of that. The CIA had information, the FBI had information. Nobody talked to each other, and nobody could connect the dots.
Yeah.
And organized crime works in exactly the same way. And in fact, they love the fragmentation within police service because it allows them to have a free hand.
Yep. Yep. Have you had much feedback from any policing agencies on the book?
I have. I mean, the Australian Federal Police here have asked me to present on it on a couple of important forums in terms of with their executive management and other agencies and other places I've been to in the world and have had contact with. They've shown a keen interest. I know when the book first came out, it was launched at the European Society of Criminology Conference in September 2010, and I distinctly recall the commissioning editor ringing me up and telling me with great delight that they actually sold the book out at the conference. He said, "We've never had a book rushed like that so much."
Oh, he wasn't generous enough to fly you to the conference.
No. It wasn't generous enough to get me over to Oxford. I just got a phone call. But I was over there later in the year and did confirm that, yes, they had to fly some more books over because... And the book sales are doing well, and from what I can see, when I occasionally get a bit of a printout, there are a lot of agencies and people, a diverse group, have looked at and hopefully are using some of the ideas.
Well, I think there's a very unusual thing for an academic to be saying, I think the book sales are doing well. That'd be pretty rare.
Well, it wasn't meant as I use it as a textbook, but really it was meant for a wider audience, you know, for really sort of policy, government policy direction, policing. It's got applications for a whole range of people, yeah.
But you're not going to get a movie deal.
I don't think so, no. No, probably they'd make a movie deal out of the 35 or so case studies in there, and each of them in the brief vignettes would, there'd be a storyline you could write about them, you know.
Yeah.
Some of them are quite horrific, yeah.
Any chance that any of the criminal groups are buying it to learn how?
Yeah, oh, I'm sure the smart ones would definitely be on the hit list for the sales.
You heard it here first.
I wouldn't expect otherwise. I mean, I put in my foreword that one of the great difficulties in writing this, with the level of detail and specificity, was how do you write that in a way that doesn't allow a criminal group to get better at what it's doing, which is a real dilemma. But I also face the issue of, but we need to educate police and agencies and governments in a better way to go about this, or else we really will continue to never get a handle on organised crime. So it was a sort of a trade-off. There's some stuff I just didn't put in the book that would have been good, but you hold it for a training course or a workshop with a closed audience, because you just don't want to give away too many trade secrets, so to speak. But I think, I probably rationalise it. Well, most crime groups that are smart and getting somewhere, they would have known this already. It's probably just confirmed their intuitions, and they'll probably have a smirk and a smile about it, but hopefully won't give them too much of a competitive advantage. But it hopefully will give police a much better handle and law enforcement agencies on and a competitive advantage against such groups. Yeah.
Oh, great, great. So I suppose we can move on now to another important question, and that's, what are you working on now? What's coming up next for Jeff?
I suppose, I have a lot of interests in research interests. I mean, police corruption and so forth, and I will certainly continue to write in organised crime. Probably what's attracted my interest at the moment is really trying to extend the knowledge management policing framework and the principles and practices that I'm sort of developing and refining as I go about writing these books into sort of further uncharted waters like terrorism and violent extremism. Because while there's a lot written about those topics and a lot of obviously research and that is gone on as a result of the 9/11, I don't really think we have much of a conceptual handle on that in a much more pragmatic way that I would like to see. So I'm really looking at trying to develop some sort of complexity model of that sort of violent extremism and melding that with knowledge managed policing, because of the way that I've been refining that work. So, yeah, that'll keep me busy for the next few years, I would think.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. That's good. And is Petter involved in that one as well?
Possibly not. We've got other projects we do with Petter, but I don't know whether that'll end up in a book or whether I'll do a third one with Oxford. I'm just a bit booked out at the moment. I've been very. But I certainly will continue researching, and there'll be some joint publications, as I like to do with a whole range of people around the world, in a sort of multidisciplinary way, because no one discipline has it all. And I would expect that hopefully somebody listening to this interview might want to say, well, listen, yeah, I can write something with this guy, or I can do that, and I'll be looking forward to any further correspondence.
Excellent. Well, there you go. You have an open offer.
Just let me pencil it into my diary. It's getting a bit full. Yeah.
Yes. Well, actually, I think Jeff's information, contact details, will be put on the New Books Network website as well when I put up the blog for this podcast. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time, Jeff. Very interesting conversation about this book. And as I said, I have had the opportunity to teach out of this book, and it's a very, very thorough examination of the issue. So thank you very much, and we better close there.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. You've been listening to Jeff Dean talk about his new book, Organised Crime, Policing Illegal Business and Entrepreneurialism, published by Oxford University Press. I'm Mark Locks, the co-host of New Books in Terrorism and Organised Crime. Thank you for listening.